Sat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, FM and satellites. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5, and Intelsat 39, and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395 6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Spotlight. For over four decades, the Zionist Project in Palestine has faced an unwavering and indomitable force, the Islamist resistance and movement in Lebanon. Since 1982, the myth of an invincible Israeli army has been shattered again and again by the will, faith, and strategic depth of Hezbollah. In the recent 2024 war, the enemy attempted to test this resolve, dreaming of invasions and victories. But what did they find? They found a resistance that is not just an army, but a society deeply rooted in the land and its people. They were stopped in their tracks, their objectives unfulfilled. Today, we are witnessing the next phase of this enduring victory. The resistance is not merely rebuilding, it is evolving, learning, and fortifying itself in ways that go beyond mere weaponry. It is deepening its integration with the very environment and fabric of Lebanon, making its strength inseparable from the nation itself. Now we stand at a precipice. Israel's escalating attacks and continued occupation are pushing the region toward a wider war. Each violation is not just an act of aggression, but a step closer to a conflict for which the resistance has been preparing. Before we get started, let's go ahead. More details in this report.
Israel has escalated its drone attacks on Lebanon in violation of the ceasefire with the Arab country. Just this week alone, over a dozen airstrikes targeted the eastern and southern parts of the country, leaving many casualties. It was the latest in near-daily Israeli violations of a ceasefire that began in November last year. The ceasefire was meant to end almost a year of limited fighting and 2 months of full-scale war. But Israel continues its attacks regardless of the ceasefire. The regime claims that it targets sites linked to Hezbollah, but evidence on the ground shows that civilians are the actual victims of such attacks. The prolonged violations have caused mounting civilian casualties and widespread destruction. Most recently, Lebanon's health authorities announced that 274 people have been killed in Israeli attacks since November last year. A recent report by the multinational United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon also highlighted that in the same period, some 950 projectiles were fired by Israel into Lebanon in addition to 100 Israeli airstrikes. The regime also maintains a military presence at five outposts in Lebanon, despite the truce requiring its full withdrawal earlier this year. UN human rights experts have also accused Israel of violating terms of the ceasefire by failing to withdraw from southern Lebanon. Lebanese President Joseph Aoun has asked both the U.S. and France to intervene to rein in Israel, but to no avail. Many analysts are now warning that Israel may be preparing for a full-scale war under the guise of attempting to disarm Hezbollah, a red line for the Lebanese resistance group. Several indicators support this theory, including a significant increase in military strikes and recent threats made by Israeli officials against Lebanon. In addition, the IOF recently concluded a large-scale five-day exercise led by the 91st Division, simulating combat operations along the Lebanon border. Israel has described the exercise as the largest since the war began, emphasizing its goal of improving operational readiness through reserve mobilization and force buildup. However, it remains to be seen whether these maneuvers signal an impending escalation or are simply drills?
Well, to analyze the profound strategic dimensions of this new phase, we are joined by Ms. Leila Khatoum, Editor-in-Chief of MENA Uncensored, joining us from Beirut. And Ms. Batula Subaiti, activist and political analyst, joining us from London. Well, ladies, I'd like to thank you both for joining us during this episode of Spotlight. Ms. Khatoum, let's go ahead and start off with you. Now, let's begin with the possibility of an escalation, specifically with the recent developments. Earlier this week, as we heard in the report, Israel's media military spokesperson spoke of this completion of the military drills in southern Lebanon. Now, let's remind our viewers that there are still five very strategic locations that they refuse to give up, and they've even built posts on them. In your opinion, Ms. Khatoum, does this mean they are planning a major attack?
Good evening to you, to your viewers, and to your esteemed guests as well. And I have to point out something that's very important. These are not drills, it's war. They're attacking us. These are breaches to the cessation of hostilities agreement. And they have built in five strategic positions, but they maintain over nine occupied, newly occupied territories inside Lebanon, aside from the previously occupied territories inside Lebanon. So the Israeli occupation is actually expanding inside Lebanese territories. It continues to breach the cessation of hostilities agreement. It's not a ceasefire agreement, as they try to say it. Our president and even the Israeli side had said multiple times it's a cessation of hostilities. They haven't stuck to their end of the deal. And that tells you one thing, that the Israelis will never honor any agreement. I mean, their past actually is a witness, a sense testament to the fact that they never honored any agreement. From now, like, go back 3,000 years ago, even with God, they never kept that pact. So for me, that the Israelis continuing to maintain these positions inside Lebanese territories, continuing to occupy Lebanese territories, continuing to kill and murder Lebanese citizens, including recently an 82-year-old woman. She comes from my mom's village, by the way, and basically sent nearly 75 projectiles. These are not projectiles, missiles into Lebanese territories per day, about 900 plus for the past 12 months. That tells you one thing. But the Israelis are trying to escalate. They're trying to push further and further until basically what they do is basically create a war and a situation that allows them to demolish most of the territories inside South Lebanon and then take over just like they did in Gaza.
And Mrs. Bates, we're going to go and bring you in from London, continuing what Ms. Khatoum did bring up. We know that Israel's pretext has always been that they are so-called targeting Hezbollah's infrastructure and such. But as the reality shows, again, as Ms. Khatoum mentioned, the 82-year-old lady who was martyred, we have the killing of families, we have the killing of elderly, we have the killing of blind citizens who were injured during the previous pager terrorist attack. And even they have targeted heavy machinery that are basically even trying to rebuild homes over the last war. Why is Israel escalating its attacks despite this ceasefire?
Hi, good evening to you and your guests and your viewers. These are routine actions of the Israeli occupation entity. Ultimately, right now, it wants to create a buffer between Lebanon and the entity, and it wants to make life impossible. It wants to make the living conditions impossible to materialize. And ultimately, Israel doesn't distinguish between the people and the resistance because it considers the people are the resistance. They are the supportive environment of the resistance. So it doesn't want the people to return back to their homes in the south. So it targets any infrastructure that seeks to reconstruct. Does all of this mean that we're expecting like a kind of larger scale war or confrontation? I don't think so. A ceasefire, as we saw it, it stopped the invasion or the illusion that Israel could invade and reach the heart of Beirut. But ultimately, whatever bank of targets the entity has from its previous confrontation, it will hit. And it will seek to make life impossible to live within the border. And I believe that within this limit, the occupation entity right now is operating. There is no larger war happening. Why? Not because Israel's not bloodthirsty, but because it's unable to engage in it. And it is at its most comfortable state right now, if you will. That is, it's striking as and when it pleases without a direct reaction from the Lebanese resistance. The war in its current form is by virtue of continuity, one that is ongoing. But I don't believe either side wants a full return to an all-out war, because ultimately it's not in the interest of the entity, nor is it in the interest of the resistance, except if the resistance is forced to intervene into a larger scale war. What we're seeing is Israel roaming freely it comes and goes, bombs and destroys in the border areas. It assassinates those who it has information about without finding a response from the resistance, ultimately because the resistance right now is busy with something greater, and that's actually the process of rebuilding its structures and its capabilities, repairing what is lost, and reorganizing its affairs on new foundations that fit new orientations.
Yes, well, actually, when we talk about Israel freely roaming around, I mean, I do have to come back to Ms. Hatoum for this question. Let's cross over to the so-called international mediators, Ms. Hatoum. I mean, how would you describe the U.S. and specifically the French, of course, their failure in this mediation? I mean, everyone knows that it's not that they can't, but they won't stop and they won't basically pause these Israeli violations. Why is it exactly?
Well, it's the biggest joke of them all to have the people who are funding the Israeli entity and arming it and supporting it to fly above international law, giving it impunity on the international level, be the mediators. They are no honest brokers, as we call them. So those people are found inside Lebanese territories to try to rein in the Lebanese rather than basically try to force the Israelis to stop. Much like when you hear the Americans speak about an international task force to be sent to Gaza, this is not going to be to actually secure the safety of the people of Gaza, but rather to actually ensure the safety of the Israelis from inside Gaza towards the Israeli entity. So at the end of the day, those, what we call them MTC for Lebanon, the Military Technical Committee for Lebanon, we recently heard them say that they are going to work towards telling the Israelis to stop. Like, they're not going to force the Israelis to stop. These people are not our friends. These people are the new mandate powers who are there to ensure that the Israeli occupation can roam freely and that nobody can touch it. And they do that by threatening the Lebanese. And unfortunately, we're seeing the Lebanese officials caving in. Everybody, no exception, from the government, from the parliament and elsewhere, they're just basically kneeling in front of these threats instead of basically fighting them. When it comes to your guest, she said that she doesn't believe that war is going to come. When the Israelis are going to attack and attack and attack, they're creating the situation of pumping the people. Somebody's bound to retaliate, and that's going to cause the first spark. We are in sort of what you call Cold War. They attack us. We're waiting. They're rebuilding. Yes, the resistance is rebuilding, but that doesn't mean that the war is not coming.
And when we talk about failure, I mean, we have to bring in the inaction of the Lebanese government. Ms. Hatoum did bring it up a bit. I'm going to elaborate more on it with Ms. Sabaita joining us again from London. Ms. Sabaita, for those who actually don't understand how politics work in Lebanon, why isn't the government pursuing, whether we're talking about pursuing Israel at the UN for its war crimes or even taking any kind of concrete action to stop Israel attacks, as they are indeed specifically over the last month, killing innocent civilians on a daily basis?
Yes, absolutely. I just want to make a point on the last point that Leila made, and that is that the previous leadership was American and the current one is also American, of course, but it was America ultimately that gave Netanyahu the free hand to do whatever he wants in Lebanon and in Gaza. So we always need to remember that was the American decision before it was even an Israeli decision. If Israel reached Beirut, America wouldn't have said no to that. That's America's dream before it's Israel's dream. But now there is something that is important, and that is that returning to a wider war is not favored after stopping the war with Gaza. So on that basis, I think it's unlikely for war, like a full-scale war, to return to Lebanon, since this phase is one of settlements between entering a war and the resistance in Lebanon emerging victorious and holding a lot of the areas in the south and in Lebanon. And for the situation to remain as it is with a government in charge, as you've mentioned and your guest has mentioned, America wants this current government with Aoun and Salam. They bought them and they're in their favor. This is America's government. Even if it's not 100% in control, it wants the coexistence between them, between the two sides here. And so I do believe that the American establishment's position is different from before the ceasefire. Prior, Israel had the complete free hand, and now America doesn't want a big escalation because it doesn't want the situation to get out of hand and to collapse. As you mentioned, for your specific question over here, the Prime Minister and the President, they were bought in by the Americans and by their guarantors in the region, in the Gulf regimes, the Saudis. They will walk within the Western strategy. The Lebanese government are not patriotic. They don't care about the interests of the Lebanese nation or its sovereignty. They have interests in the West that they don't want to let go of. They don't want to see Lebanon sanctioned, and America even would, in that situation, if the Lebanese government did not follow their direction, but even prevent Lebanon from receiving aid from any other directional side. So, for example, if China wants to give Lebanon money, it will not reach them due to the American decision, similar to what we've been seeing with the Islamic Republic of Iran and its sanctioning. But ultimately, this Lebanese government has no concept of sovereignty, but there are limits to their movement. You know, they tell the Americans, if we want to enter into confrontation with the resistance, the resistance can overcome us because they're much stronger, because they have a real foundational base on the ground. They have their own army and they have a strong supporting base. And so the Americans tell them that it's important that, that you stay and that you continue to pressurize the resistance, but don't lose the parts of leverage that you have. But why they don't demand sovereignty, if that's the question. From the start of the Israeli occupation entity's attacks on Lebanon, even if we go back to the 1980s, the Lebanese government was silent, as though the South is not a part of Lebanon. So this is not new, and nor should we expect the Lebanese government, whose decisions rests with the West and its Arab counterparts, to really go in the direction of caring about Lebanon's sovereignty.
And with it, since we are talking about the Lebanese government, let's go ahead and also, Ms. Hatoum, I mean, in your opinion, there's a lot of people around the world who support the resistance, support Hezbollah, but again, they don't understand the Lebanese government. And in your opinion, how can we explain to them about why the government is not officially supporting the resistance right to defend Lebanon? I mean, for over four decades, hasn't Hezbollah proven that it's the only effective defense against the Zionist entity?
Well, the thing is, Hezbollah was effective in fighting the Israeli entity, not because of its numbers or missiles, but also because it had joined hands with another political party that's also armed on the ground, that's Amal Movement, and they had unified the umbrella of resistance that's actually helped them to be more effective against the enemy. When it comes to the fighting that's happening within the cabinet or outside it, I'll give you three examples, three facts that explain to you why the government is not patriotic. You have a large number of the ministers holding foreign passports. They have interests abroad, as your esteemed guest had said. So basically, they fear to lose any of those, interests. The second part is basically some of those ministers belong to right-wing political parties that actually collaborated with the Israelis during the civil war and helped torture and kill Lebanese on behalf of the Israelis. And I'm talking about not only the Lebanese forces, Forces Party, LFP, but also the Falangists, among others. And the foreign affairs minister, I'll give you that example. He one day, when he was asked, why aren't you complaining to the international community or speaking or denouncing the Israeli attacks against Lebanese civilians and killing them? He said, well, every day the Israelis are killing Lebanese citizens, so do I have to denounce it every day? I mean, like, that's his job, right? And the third fact is that Nawaf Salam, our current prime minister, is actually one of the brokers of the peace deal with the Israelis back in the 1980s, the 17th of May agreement. So he was one of the advisors that were advising on that, what you call agreement to normalize ties with the Israelis. So that tells you basically where he stands. So when it comes, when you combine all of that together, and the fact that the Americans and the British are supporting them, the fact that all the propaganda we see on YouTube using AI is paid for by the Israelis and the right-wing groups in support of that government, that tells you that this government doesn't belong to the people.
Well, Mrs. Speighton, let's go ahead and stem up from those three great examples that Ms. Hatoum did give us. Let's go ahead. We have to bring in this disarmament demand. Now, isn't this demand for disarmament from, of course, let's start off the Lebanese government, the Zionist regime, and, of course, let's not forget the U.S. Isn't this a demand for surrendering? I mean, basically, this is what they want, is it not? To remove Hezbollah, to go ahead and expand on their greater Israel plan.
Right. The Israeli occupation entity, of course, has something, and its goal is expansionism. America has its own interests, and that is for the region to remain hostage to its interests and uses the Israeli occupation entity in this regards to act as its patron in the region. And of course, the resistance wants liberation against occupation, and of course, it has demonstrated that it will come in support of Palestine and enter as a front in this regards. America has allowed Israel to operate within limits to fulfill its goals that it has proven that it is unable to achieve, not in Gaza nor in Lebanon. Now I believe this phase that we are in is more political. The Lebanese government is fulfilling the American decision, which does not right now support entering into a direct confrontation with the Lebanese resistance in terms of a full-scale war, but one that actually pressures the resistance in a way that limits its presence, as we've been describing the attacks in the south. The realities are not working in this direction, though, because the resistance has foiled Israel's larger goals and is reorganizing itself. We are in the day after the Gaza war, certainly what Israel and the Americans could not obtain during their direct war on Gaza, they will not be able to obtain now, if you could call this peacetime or, you know, that kind of cessation of hostilities on the level that it was prior. They could not, during the war, complete the mission against the resistance by ending it, forcing it to hand over its weapons, destroying its tunnels, removing its leaders from Gaza, or expelling its members from the Strip to other places. The point is, what they could not achieve during the days of the war was certainly not, they will not be able to achieve that in peacetime. So at the point that the war ends, the short phrase that describes the whole situation is incapacity. The incapacity of the Americans and the Israelis. The Americans have reached this conclusion after they opened every door for the entity to reach the extent that it wanted to reach. Israel has been given every single chance in these past 2 years to basically get the resistance to surrender and apply the maximum level of destruction that it can, even if that meant storming and occupying countries and capitals. You know, nations fell, sovereignty fell, and all considerations were cast aside in favor of the entity's security, what was called the New Middle East or Greater Israel. Everything in the region in these past 2 years was handled on that basis, that there is a public audience, and this public is made up of tribes and ethnic, racial, sectarian groups, dealt with by providing livelihood opportunities under Western control. You know, what like Tom Barak now calls the
exactly.
Prosperity.
Mrs. Speita, I don't mean to cut you off. I do want to get at least one more question. It seems our time is very close to ending. Ms. Hatoum, you are a citizen, you live there in Lebanon, you see the people around you. The resistance has been part of the nation, has been part of the people. It has prevented the spillover of Daesh. It has freed southern villages that were occupied for so long by the Zionist entity. It crushed the Zionist dreams back in 2006 and just last year in 2024. There's so much more to the resistance than people may think. What is your message to the Lebanese people specifically who still believe that disarming Hezbollah or even perhaps normalizing with Israel will bring peace?
Well, if they haven't understood the message loud and clear when the Israelis tell them that Lebanon is part of Greater Israel and that they want to take over it, and the fact that the Israelis are adamant at disarming the Lebanese resistance, that tells you one thing, that the Israelis don't want any handicap in the, towards achieving their dream. So instead of allowing the Israelis to achieve that dream, why don't you just support a Lebanese against a foreign enemy?
Well, with that, I'd like to thank both of our ladies for joining us today in this episode of Spotlight. Ms. Leila Hatoum, Editor-in-Chief at MENA Uncensored, joining us from Beirut. And, of course, Ms. Batoula Speita, activist and political analyst. They're joining us from London. A pleasure to have you both. Till next time, goodbye.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله
Answering your doubts and questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs
Allah هو إذا الرحمن Allah هو إذا المنان
لا إله إلا الله
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
So, Sheikh Rahimi, today we'll continue our discussion regarding the will of God and its role in the crimes in Gaza. Is it Allah's will or free will of the people? According to what you say, it is not God's will. God has given the people free will, and the Zionists, based on the free will, are doing such ethnical cleansing, we can say, in ethnic cleansing in Gaza. So now the major question is that does Satan have control over our free will, and what is the role of causality in here?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. As I mentioned in the previous session, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has some, let's say, traditions, sunnahs, principles to run this world. One of them is free will, and we somehow prove that this world is a much better place with free will than with predestination.
All
so
right.
If we are going to have free will, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is not going to remove free will. It's not going to take this will from the people. Every person is given free will, and they are going to do their actions based on their choice. And of course, then on the day of judgment, there would be reward and punishment.
All right.
And of course, there is a role for the Satan. I mean, when it comes to our free will, we choose because of, different factors. I mean, different factors have influence on our choice. One of them is the temptations by the desires and also by the Satan.
All right.
But at the end of the day, there is no force by the Satan.
Okay.
As he himself mentioned on the Day of Judgment that I did not force them. Uh-huh. I just invited them and they accepted my invitation.
So as if there is no predestination by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on doing good things or doing bad things.
Yeah.
From the Satan side is so, isn't it?
Exactly.
But Satan also does temptations. Okay, yeah. That's it. Okay.
So having said that, I go to the second principle,
yes,
which is also very important. And as I mentioned, if we understand these principles, we can answer many other questions. And that is the concept of causality.
Causality.
The fact that everything in this world is working based on cause and effect principle.
All right.
And there are verses and narrations referring to that. For example, chapter Rome, verse 41. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم ظهر الفساد في البر والبحر بما كسبت أيدي الناس. Corruption has appeared in land and sea because of the doings of the people's hands. So the cause is there, the effect is there. Chapter Ra'd, verse 11. إن الله لا يغير ما بقوم حتى يغير ما بأنفسهم. Indeed, Allah does not change a people's lot unless they change what is in their souls. So, but as I mentioned in the previous session, although the Zionist regime, they are doing that based on free will, based on causality, but the Muslims are also able to do something based on these principles.
All right.
The Muslim leaders, the Muslim nations,
okay,
if they act upon their obligations, for sure we would have not seen such a crimes to be committed by Zionist regime.
You mean the silence that some of
exactly.
them, silence complicity we call it, that's right.
Yeah,
they are accomplice in being silent in the crimes in Gaza. That's why.
Yeah, let's remember the famous statement by Imam Khomeini, rahmatullahi alayhi, that if each Muslim just pour a glass of water mm-hmm. on, Zionist regime, then they would have been disappeared.
Fade away, that's right. Okay.
And also, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, وَكُلُّ قَائِمٍ فِي سِوَاهُمْ مَعْلُونَ. And Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, أَبَى اللَّهُ أَنْ يَجْرِ الْأَشْيَاءَ. And this is a very interesting narration. أَبَى اللَّهُ أَنْ يَجْرِ الْأَشْيَاءَ إِلَّا بِأَسْبَابٍ. Allah is going to run this world based on cause and effect. فَجَعَلَ لِكُلِّ شَيْءٍ سَبَبًا. Allah has made for every effect a cause. Now, again, I repeat the question. Is this world a better place with causality or without causality?
Mm-hmm.
Imagine there is no causality. I mean, the whole system would collapse. For example, you eat food, but you do not get satiated. You do not get filled.
Yes.
Or you are thirsty, but if you drink water, still you are thirsty. Because
okay.
there is no cause and effect. So the point is that cause and effect should work. Otherwise, there is no science at all. I mean, medicine, everything is based on cause and effect. If you're able to discover the reasons for illnesses, it is because of cause and effect, and so on and so forth.
That's
so,
right.
I mean, a world without cause and effect is not a place to live.
That's right.
I mean, you are hungry, but you are not sure if you eat you will be full,
okay,
because there is no cause and effect.
And you as human being, through human agency, are responsible for the causes, isn't it?
Yeah.
You mean you cause something to be good or evil. So at the end of the day, the effects are directly the fruits of your actions as the cause.
Mm.
Now the major question is that, does Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala have control over the relation between the two? Can he change it or not? For example, a specific cause might have a specific effect. But does Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala have control over this aliyah?
That's the point.
Okay.
My point is that this world is designed by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to act based on cause and effect.
Uh-huh.
So if there is fire, it's going to burn. If there is a knife, it's going to cut. There are just very few cases as exceptions, as miracles, like in the case of Ibrahim alayhi salam, when he was put into the fire, it was turned to a garden. Or when Ibrahim alayhi salam was about to slaughter Ismail, the knife didn't work. So these are just very few exceptions. But generally speaking, cause and effect are going to work, and this is the will of God. So the army of Yazid is going to kill Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the cause is there, the sword is there, and it is going to work, and Imam Hussein alayhi salam is martyred.
All right.
If the Zionist regime, they are using the cause, that is their weapons,
all right,
whatever they have, then the result, the effect is that the martyrdom of 70,000 innocent people.
Okay.
So my point is that this is the will of God, that this war should work based on two principles, free will and cause and effect. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, and as I mentioned, we need to pay attention to these two principles. In many cases, we can, analyze theological discussions through these two. For example, sometimes we are told that why we have disabled newborn children.
Uh-huh.
Again, answering this, we need to remember free will, cause and effect.
Okay.
And of course, Allah will make it up for the people who have no role in such negative consequences.
All right.
Or for example, why some of our prayers are not answered by God, cause and effect. So it can be helpful in answering many theological discussions. Now, having said that, I go and come back to the main question. So for the people of Gaza, first of all, there is the issue of cause and effect and free will. Second of all, when it comes to such events, we cannot and we should not evaluate them only based on the current condition and situation. Remember, before Moses alayhi salam was born, Pharaoh used to, kill so many innocent children.
Yes.
And there are very sad stories like burning the pregnant women and their children in the hot water and
That's
so
right.
on and so forth. So maybe a person at that time would say, so where is God? But the point is that we should not just look at one spot in the history.
Mm-hmm.
Later, the same Musa is born. Although so many crimes were performed by Pharaoh. But later, the very prophet Musa alayhi salam is able to guide the children of Israel. And through his guidance, they pass through the river. And the army of Pharaoh are drowned in the sea. And now, who is remembered as a good person? Moses.
Yes.
All the people talk negatively about Pharaoh. So this is another point that we should not just look at this spot in the history. Yes, on Muharram, the 10th of Muharram, 61 after Hijrah, the Imam of the Shia, the Imam of all Muslims, is brutally killed by Yazid and so many of his companions and family members, and they are taken as captives.
Mm-hmm.
So at that spot, this is a very heinous crime and very difficult to tolerate. But in the long term, you see that there are so many fruits, positive results of that, uprising of Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
That's right.
And nowadays, millions of people across the world remember Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his virtues, go to visit him, but there is Yazid and those people.
So you mean that the crimes, the heinous crimes that are taking place in Gaza and Palestine, of course, right now that we are talking, I think peace negotiation is signed and maybe there is no attack, but there are still so many crippled, people over there living because of the crimes of the Israel. Now, the question is that so many years from now, there would be a big lesson spot of the history.
That's the point.
And at that time, the people will say, why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala directly does not interfere in, for example, stopping the Zionists from killing?
There are so many examples like this in the history of humanity. Jesus alayhi salam, for many years, he was under the persecution of the Jews. Noah alayhi salam, for hundreds of years, he invited the people. But later, we saw the results. Our prophet, remember what the companions of the prophet went through in the city of Mecca. Remember, the parents of Ammar Yasser. Yasser and Sumayya,
yes.
How brutally they were killed. So at that spot in the history, some people would say that, would argue, would object that, so where is God? But 10 years later, the prophet is able to establish a government.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the beginning of a new civilization in the whole history of mankind.
That's right.
I talked about the tragedy of Karbala and the everlasting positive results of that. So my point is that when it comes to such crimes, again, we should not be stopped in one point in the history.
All right.
We need to broaden our picture and wait for, I mean, good days coming for the people of Palestine as well.
That's right.
So
so we can say that the so causality in this way is a custom of Allah, isn't it?
Yeah, and the tradition of
and
God.
The tradition sunnah.
And Allah, the last one that I would like to share is that, as I mentioned, Allah Subhanahu wa Taala is going to give time to the unjust people,
yes.
to the oppressors.
All right.
He's not going to, for example, kill them as soon as they commit a crime. Otherwise, there is no free will anymore. Imagine. Mm-hmm. Any person who commits a crime, as I mentioned in the previous session, he is killed by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So the next day, all the people would act righteously.
All right.
But there is no value in that because they are not going to do that based on their free will anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So Allah's tradition is to give some time, some respite to the oppressors. And sometimes there is another sunnah, another tradition based on the Noble Book of Quran verses. It is called Istidraj.
Yes.
I ask yes. the listeners to search about this word, Istidraj.
Yes. Yes.
Sometimes Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is giving some time to the oppressors and they think that it is good for them.
And but some reality, facilities.
Yeah, but they're in reality, they are increasing their wrong
actions.
We can
roughly translate into English as the gradual downfall.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
right.
Very good translation.
Gradual downfall, yeah, in terms of the facilities.
And the final point is that, as I mentioned, we should not limit our perspective to one spot in the history. We
All
should
right.
not also limit our perspective into this world.
Mm-hmm.
We need to know that there is another world. For the people who are innocently killed, for sure there is a very great destiny waiting for them in the hereafter.
That's right.
And as I have explained in many other sessions, every suffering in this world will be made up and rewarded by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala much more so that every person wishes for their life in this world to be full of disasters
That's
and
right.
hardships. So for the innocent people who are martyred innocently, Allah
yes.
subhanahu wa ta'ala will reward them. And of course, for unjust people, for the oppressors,
okay.
either they are punished in this world, and of course, the main punishment is waiting for them in the hereafter.
That's right. So respecting and operating within the system of the causes is absolutely accepted in Islam,
yeah.
while believing that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the main causer of the causes, okay?
Sure.
I mean, sometimes in terms of the bad things, we put the responsibility on the shoulder of Allah and the good things on our shoulder,
yeah,
okay? And this is not true, okay?
Yeah.
That's not true. Thank you, Masha Karimi, for a nice elaboration regarding this concept. May Allah save the people of Palestine and save the people of Gaza. And may Allah save the people who, we can't say, are passing really harsh life now in Gaza, the people who are getting back to their homeland. They have no homes. Rubble is over there, wreckage is over there, and they are really tolerating
and
a difficult
may Allah
life.
Awaken the whole Muslim, all
Inshallah.
The Muslim and the humanity
Inshallah.
As a whole.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Sheikh Karimi.
My pleasure.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. To another episode, God bless you all. Fiyaman. لعلي وحسين وحسان إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسان لعلي وحسين وحسان كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
Nasir Khosrow Street is the oldest street in Tehran. It extends from Imam Khomeini Square to 15 Khordad Street in Tehran's Bazaar District. Along the way are some of the most iconic buildings and places of the capital, such as Darul Funun School, Sarai Roshan, Shamsul Emare Building, and Marvi Alley. Nasir Khosrow is more than just a street. You just need to walk from one end to another in order to travel to the past without even leaving the present. Join me in this historic journey. The construction of Nasir Khosrow Street dates back to 1906. Before that date, the street was part of a large ditch in this area. After the construction of new trenches, they filled the ditch and it became Nasiriye Street because it was built by the order of Nasiruddin Shah Qajar. The best way to know the central part of a city is to visit its historical places. Darul Funun School, the first modern school of Iran, which was founded in 1851 by Mirza Taqi Khan Amir Kabir. Muhammad Taqi Amir Nizam, known as Amir Kabir, was the prime minister of Iran during the reign of Nasiruddin Shah Qajar. During his time, Amir Kabir exercised administrative programs, cultural and economic reforms for the country. And certainly, his most important work was the foundation of Darul Funun. Darul Funun School played a major role in the process of modernization of Iran. We continue our journey on the road to the south. It is interesting that the first pharmacy, the first printing press, and the first school of Iran were all in this street. In its central section, most buildings date back to the early 20th century, and some of these historical buildings have been preserved.
Towards the middle of the Nasir Khosrow Street, Sarai Roshan rises as a historical symbol of this area, one of the first commercial buildings of the capital city. Its unique style is inspired by Gothic architecture.
Only 2 to 3 minutes walk from Sarai Roshan, we find another unique building, which is called Shamsul Emare.
In this street, you can enjoy the architecture of a building called Shamsul Emare, or the Edifice of the Sun. Shamsul Emare is one of the most impressive structures of the Gulistan Palace, which was built around 150 years ago by the order of Nasiruddin Shah Qajar. I'm sure he had a perfect view of the city of Tehran when he was standing up there.
Shamsul Emare is the first five-story building in the capital, and at the time was considered the tallest building in Tehran. The building combines traditional Iranian architecture with European one. The facade of this building is decorated with bricks and colorful tiles with some beautiful paintings.
The famous Marvi Alley is located right across the street to Shamsul Emare building. Here you can find many different shops and boutiques for all different tastes and budgets. This part of the market attracts tourists and customers from different socioeconomic levels.
Marvi School is located in the same alley, and it is one of the oldest seminaries in Iran. This school was built almost about 200 years ago. The Marvi School is a 4,500 square meters space and has a capacity for about 200 students. The schoolyard is a square garden and it includes several rooms, a library consisting of old books, and a small pond in the middle.
Before I say goodbye to this street, I'm going to try some street food here because Tehran's Bazaar district is famous for its tasty foods. I was told that the falafel sandwich of this area is just awesome. And indeed it is, so I hope you get a chance to try it too. Shahriyar Azimi for Iran.
City with a population of around 13 million people. It's a modern city with a modern architecture. Flats and high-rise buildings rule the whole city. From the outside, it's quite dense and all the houses look the same. But from the inside, well, let's go and see what makes the architecture of some of the buildings quite different from the rest. For some of the architects in the country, building a structure is not just about keeping up with the latest architectural trends. It's more about building a house that adapts with the functional needs of its users. Let's take a look at this one.
This is the Sharifiha House, a flexible structure with three turning boxes or rooms that can be rotated 90 degrees to open up the terrace during hot summers and turned back to a horizontal position to keep the house warmer during the cold, snowy winters. Ali Taghabouni is the mastermind behind the creation. He was inspired by the country's traditional houses, which offered both a winter and a summer living room for the residents.
So right now we're going to see another house. It's basically a childhood dream come true. An eco-friendly house that will certainly blow your mind away.
A portable house made from wood and built in just 3 days. 72 pieces to be precise. 36 parts for the roof and 36 for the body, all fastened with screws. It's not one of the usual houses that you see each day. It's a house that connects you to nature and makes you feel calm and restful, undisturbed from the outside world. Abbas Iftikhari is the architect of this house, who has been living here with his family ever since it was built. He has studied industrial design, restoration of historic monuments and interior design, and he has been teaching them all in the university for 18 years. Mr. Iftikhari told me that wood is a naturally grown and engineered material which contributes to an overall removal of greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. At the same time, it's structurally strong and acts as a natural insulator due to the air pockets within its cellular structure. The family's sun clock was also interesting to see. Mr. Iftikhari explained to me that as the sun moves across the sky, the shadow aligns with different hour lines which are marked on the dial to indicate the time of the day. Every nook and corner of the house was also filled with different wooden sculptures. And as we understood, Abbas Iftikhari has a hand in sculpting too.
A It's a dreamy experience, rubbing your hands on the different shapes of wood and smelling the woody fragrance and looking at the colourful, delicate veins as they each tell you their life story. We live in a world constantly surrounded by technology. Maybe it's about time we got in touch with Mother Nature, becoming environmentally aware and reconnecting with the energy of the universe. Hoda Lezgi for Iran.
Aquí Teherán, la voz de la República Islámica de Irán.
Estimados oyentes, ahora escucharán las aleyas 9 a 11 de la sura de Hud del Sagrado Corán recitadas por el señor Baghefi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم